The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, it's times like these that we like to have Bill King on, because we've got, you know, on one day we've got good news and all of a sudden the markets are up, and another day we've got what somebody considers bad news and the markets are way down. There doesn't seem to be any real continuity right now, and when there's not continuity on the short run, I know we like to bring somebody in who's not only got a long-term perspective but looks at the short run as well.
Well, I think what I conclude in this market is that if you're treading water, you're doing just fine.
Right.
Because it's tough to tell which direction this is going to go. And as our conversation has unfolded over the last year, the last 12 months, and even more than that, 2 or 3 years, we've regularly gone back and forth between the ideas of inflation and deflation.
Sure.
And this is an important issue because we have an outcome economically determined by decision makers in Washington and on Wall Street. And we don't know what the outcomes will be because we don't know what the decisions they'll take will look like.
And you have a clash of the titans. Okay, you've got the titans on one side that say we need more controlled socialism, we need more debt, we need to have more unity in paper, you know, like currencies. And then you've got the other side, which isn't coordinated. It's the market itself. It's like this hidden, unseen titan in a way. And these titans are fighting each other all the time.
Well, and I think what we end up seeing happen over the next 3 to 4 years is that battle become real, and ultimately somebody wins. Somebody wins the argument. And just because you win the argument doesn't mean that you were right. It just means that you were more effective in your presentation. And so it'll depend, I think, on what happens over the next couple of years, who comes into office here in Europe, all around the world, and what kind of decisions are made, and the implications, both intended and unintended, on that basis.
Wouldn't you say, David, that other than it being maybe a scary time for people because there's so much uncertainty, it is one of the most interesting times to be alive, because you've got an entire social order that's going to have to change?
Yeah, there's so much that is in the midst of changing, and so many interests that want to keep change from occurring. So there are entrenched interests that would prefer not to see things change. Meanwhile, the market is speaking, and the market is saying, we've been overcooked, we've been overdone now here for 12, 15, 20 years. We've had too much leverage in the system, too much debt in the system, and we've got to let off some steam. We've got to see an unwind of this excess. Who will be implicated in that? Kevin, we've talked long and hard with both people here in the United States and overseas as to the banking institutions, as to the individual countries, as to how individuals within those individual frameworks can be making decisions to not only survive but thrive in this environment. Thriving in this environment is probably not looking at 100, 200, 300% annual returns. That's very unrealistic. Even 10 or 15 or 20% returns may be unrealistic. Treading water, preserving your capital, keeping what you have, on balance, sitting the fence between a deflationary theme and an inflationary theme, knowing that politicians will choose one course or another and not knowing which, means that investors have to sit and wait. A very challenging thing for investors to do.
David, you talk about treading water, but actually sometimes treading water is losing a little while you're treading water. You know, there are times when you're treading water where you're not popping up and staying well above the water. You're just not drowning. And I think of what Richard Russell has said for years. It's times like these that everyone loses. It's just he who loses the least is the winner.
Well, and I think when you keep your assets intact in that way, losing the least and maintaining value, it puts you in a position, as we've discussed many years now in a row with Russell Napier, the concept that 1932, 1949, just on the verge of the launch into the bull market, 1949 to 1966,
right.
1982, and perhaps within the next 4 to 6 years, again, the unwind which leads us to the entry into a very productive period of time and a magical period of investment where you would have established cost basis at an epic low. And that is, for someone who has preserved value during these challenging times, very, very compelling.
Well, and Bill King tends to give a great bird's eye view and get you thinking on the right track for that timing. I'm wondering what the timing will be, David.
Well, Bill, it's nice to have you back on the program, and lots of questions to cover today, from quantitative easing, monetization, corporate earnings in the first quarter, the election calendar and what happens between now and the end of 2012, and a number of statistics which we should look at in detail. But, you know, if there's a big issue, what would you consider the primary concern to be if you had to just focus on one thing?
I think the big issue is, when are the leaders, the global leaders, finally going to do the requisite purging and reforms and restructuring that is necessary in the Western world and Japan? We've been going through this for over a year. Actually, the European situation has been 2 years. Nothing changes. You can trot out the same headlines, and the same headlines are being trotted out on almost a daily basis. You know, stocks are up. Oh, it's because there's encouragement that Europe's going to, you know, resolve its crisis. Stocks go down the next day. Oh, people are disappointed or not. I mean, these headlines have been repeated for 2 years, and it's the same stupidity, and it's always some goofy bailout scheme that somebody's going to lend money that they don't have. And when people call them and go, well, wait a minute, you guys are bankrupt. Well, we create a fund, and that fund will be AAA-rated. Well, excuse me, nobody's AAA-rated that is supporting the fund. How can this be AAA-rated? Oh, okay, we'll come up with a second fund. And then the stocks rally, and, you know, the garbage back and forth, but you can see it from the way the markets react. There's no leadership. Nobody will take the necessary hit or do the necessary restructuring on their watch because the political consequences are severe. So just keep pushing it out in the future.
That makes 2012 an enormous year. G20, you've got half of the G20 leaders changing next year, including in our country.
Right.
But you also see the same thing in many countries in Europe.
Yep.
And we've already seen a couple of elections already. So, yeah, nobody wants to take the hit. What do you mean? When you say the requisite purging, are we talking about in the banks?
It's everything. Sure, it's everything. You can identify, you know, I've been screaming for years that the real problem in the bank wasn't real estate here. Yeah, real estate was a problem. The real problem are derivatives that are hundreds of trillions, and the CDS on and on and on, and they're trading, and nothing's being done about it. In fact, the derivatives keep growing, and the reason they're doing it is to craft earnings. When you put rates down near zero, all your interest rates, your spread lending goes to hell. You know, you're getting deposits in the, because of the markets being weak. I just talked to a banker this weekend about it at a Christmas party, and they don't want deposits because it costs them, because the interest rates are so low, they have no place to lend, and they're getting killed on the FDIC fees because you have to pay fees on your deposits. And it's a mess because you have central planned markets with the Fed and the government, and the market is not working. It cannot clear itself, whether it's real estate prices, which are still too high when you look at national income. We either have to get national income up or real estate down, and you got these big zombie banks walking around that government just keeps pouring money in, here, Europe, wherever, and every day it just keeps going on, nothing changes. Nobody will take the axe to these guys and break them up or make them raise capital or pare down the derivative books. And you hit the key point, because the election year of 2012 for so many nations, nobody wants to go out and say, we have to take the hit. Look, you have to take the hit. You know, Reagan and Volcker took the hit in 81 and 82, and that created almost 20 years of prosperity because they cleansed the system, restructured the economy. That's what has to be done. But no one wants to take that hit now. And the longer they delay, the worse it gets. Just like tell your lies and they keep piling up and it just gets worse and worse. And that's the problem here.
So let's say that 2012 is not the year, because nobody's going to do it on a voluntary basis.
Sure.
And if they can push it to 2013.
That's what's going to happen. Right.
At what point do the issues, we're talking about fiscal issues, we're talking about economic issues, leverage in the system, derivatives, as you say, when do these things unwind on their own? They unwind in 2008. You could argue some of it began because of FASB rules and this shock to the banking system that they might actually have to mark things to market. Strange as that may sound to the man on the street, counting things at their current market value versus playing games with the numbers and calling them what you want on whatever basis. Is there a change in the rules under new leadership that causes this hit?
They got away from the mark to the market. They're marking the fantasy again. You know, everything's been thrown out. Look at what's going on with the banks. You got banks have been crafting earnings for the last at least year and a half or two by depleting their loss reserves. And that's why this last quarter the banks didn't do, is even though they reported these wonderful earnings, enough people looked at it and go, you know what, this is just, it's not only wrong, this is dangerous. they're running down their loss reserves. And you had J.P. Morgan, who is not reserving against mortgage litigation because they claim that the FDIC is going to eat that. And the FDIC is going, no, we're not going to eat your mortgage litigation costs. Anybody comes out and says, buy a bank stock because it's undervalued, doesn't know what they're talking about. You cannot buy a bank stock unless you know all the paper it has on its balance sheet and the value. And even if you know all the derivatives, all the bad paper, nobody knows the value because it's marked by some model. Go out to the market and try to sell it. See how far you get. You're not going to get far. That's the problem. And, you know, I've argued that 2008 and 9 was a crisis. It wasn't the crisis. Because when the crisis appeared in 8 and 9, central banks and governments came in and bailed out everything. The economies, the main thing, they bailed out the banks. But in the process, they've bankrupted themselves. That's what we're seeing now, is that sovereign nations, debt problems, inability to borrow, that is the game changer. Because most people, whether you're professionals in Wall Street or in the financial world, have been operating under the delusion that somebody will always bail them out, whether it was the Greenspan put, the Bernanke put, the Fed's always going to save us, the government will always bail us out. Well, what happens when, as you're seeing in Europe, when sovereign nations, people don't have confidence in them and they start hammering their debt, who bails them out? Who bails out Greece? Well, okay, we'll be the rest of Europe. Well, wait a minute. What if, with the exception of Germany, everybody else is in trouble? Well, we'll create some new entity. We'll create an EFSF fund. Well, who guarantees that? Well, it's all these bankrupt nations. Oh, okay. Well, we'll get money from the IMF. Well, wait a minute. The IMF's mostly the U.S., and the U.S. Congress has already said, no, we're not going to give you guys any money. And you can see, it goes on every day. And then you're going to create these funds by bankrupt people. That's exactly what they did with subprime mortgages. It took crappy paper, threw in one or two good securities. So look at Europe, mostly a lot of bankrupt or near bankrupt countries, throw in Germany and go, okay, we'll make it all AAA rated. That's exactly what they did with the mortgage securities with subprime. How did that work out? And that was another delusion about, oh, yeah, they're AAA rated. How could they be AAA rated when it was mostly crappy paper? It's the same thing that's going on. They're trying to create all these bailout funds. And then you saw today, the latest news, kind of the spark over the weekend was that the EU leaders wanted to put 200 billion more euros into the IMF for lending, demanded 25 billion euros from the UK, and the UK came out today and said no. But it's kind of funny. You're going to borrow money. Get this. This is what you're doing. We're going to borrow money, put it into the IMF so that we can then borrow from the IMF. It's absurd. It's a daisy chain bailout. It's unbelievable. Who is the ECB? It's the European nations, again, who were bankrupt or near bankrupt with the exception of Germany. And you have this nonsense goes on every day. And the game is to just keep this game going until some magic genie appears that will make everything better. And you can see it. Nothing is changing. There's nothing. We go day by day. The market gyrates and wiggles, and the rumors come out, and the stories, and you can see these, you know, in the afternoon now, we get like a daily rumor about an hour before the New York Stock Exchange closed about some new bailout scheme or someone's going to put up some money into some fund, and then we get a rally into the close. Well, you know, that's totally contrived because they want to keep the stock market firm going into the close. And you see last night, as soon as the, you know, the markets were under pressure for all the negative reasons over the weekend and Asia's getting hit, as soon as Asia closes, I mean, it literally closes and boom, someone takes the S&P's vertical by about 16 handles before Europe opens. Well, there's no question somebody was trying to influence the opening in Europe so that it didn't go to hell in a handbasket. And then it, you know, stayed there until about 2.5 hours before the New York Stock Exchange opened and started rolling over. We had a modestly higher opening and we've gone straight down. So it's the same nonsense every day. People are fooling in the markets, people that have vested interest to keep the stocks higher. You know, just like now, we watch everybody's. The game today is watching Bank of America. As we speak, it's trading 501. You know, 5 being a big threshold because under 5, a lot of mutual funds and pensions cannot own it. And they're afraid of some kind of collapse. And if you remember, we had this exercise a week or two ago where it traded down to 490 something or other. I can't remember. And then right before it closed, it was marked up above 5. So that's the game today, is where are they going to close Bank of America today?
Well, whether it's Bank of America, Goldman, J.P. Morgan, I mean, we're talking about U.S. banks and financials and European banks, mm-hmm. which are really in the same precarious place.
Yep.
Does 2012 represent the point in time where we see 10% of these major banks disappear, or 10% of these major banks get nationalized. You've seen Commerce Bank. Now, you know, that's been a discussion in right. Germany, this issue of what's the state involvement with running that bank now. Mm-hmm. Is nationalization the new trend in banking?
Oh, it will have to be. And I argue this is what should have been done in 2008 and 2009. That's the best way to protect the taxpayer. The taxpayers put all this money into, you know, Citi and other banks, AIG, whatever. Where's the benefit? Well, they'll give you, we sold a stock for this profit, whatever. That's garbage. Look at the money that these guys took out. Same thing with GM. You go in there and you nationalize, you wipe out all the equities, the bonds, you wipe out the contracts. And what you did is you bailed out the insiders, and in the GM case, you bailed out the unions. If you would have nationalized these banks and then spun them out, you'd save your taxpayers a lot of money.
What's the implication for pension funds and insurance companies with that wipeout of equity?
Well, you're going to lose the value if you hold those shares. That's exactly what would happen. And that's where it should be. You guys are the smartest guys in the world. You spend all this money in tuition. You get all these fees to make decisions. Why do you own this junk? And then what happens when they make money? These guys extract the money. You know, Goldman, after the crisis ebbed, made, $30 billion in one quarter? And they took $20 billion out and paid it to themselves. Why was that allowed? That's why this isn't capitalism. People go, that's what drives me nuts. This capitalism isn't working. We don't have capitalism here. We've got two things. We have crony socialism, where you give contracts to your buddies, and you got, crony capitalism. It's the same coin, just, one side or the other. You bail out your buddies or your friends or the elites on the back of taxpayers. And I know certain people always say crony capitalism. No, it's the crony socialism. That's what it really is. The socialism is government control, central planning, Fed picking winners and losers. So you can let your community banks go down and collapse. We're going to bail out not only the big U.S. banks, we're going to bail out the European banks. And then you got Dudley, the New York Fed chief, trying to tell you this is good for U.S. taxpayers to bail out European banks. Well, by a stretch of logic, what he wants to say is because if we don't, then we'll have our problems in our U.S. banks. But again, if the problems just keep getting worse, you nationalize them, you wipe out all these stock options, especially the executives, whatever, then you'll get people being prudent again. And you can see, look what happened with MF Global. This guy was head of Goldman, a U.S. senator, governor of New Jersey, and what did he do? And what happened to the firm? And what happened to the customers?
Let's talk about rehypothecation. I mean, is that anything other than theft?
No, I don't say it's theft. It's just it's stretching the limit. You know, what a lot of people aren't talking about, essentially what happened to MF Global is what happened to long-term capital management. And if you read the book, When Genius Failed, they talked about, in other press articles, when the street was talking about bailing out long-term capital, Corzine was in those meetings. He was the head of Goldman. He didn't learn anything because that's what they did. What happens on Wall Street is when you buy something, or you have money in your firm from all your different trading, you have a money desk there, and they're watching the money come in and go out, and the securities come in and come out. So what you want to do is when you buy something, you buy a U.S. bond, you immediately turn around and you try to lend it out to somebody. You repo it out, and you get funds back in. Then you buy something else. You repo that out. And so you're leveraging this up constantly. Now, what's interesting is there are limits here in the U.S. what you can do with your capital. In Europe, there's not. That's why this stuff all ends up in London. That's why, when you're saying where's missing funds, a few articles allege that the funds are in J.P. Morgan, England, in London, because there's almost limitless what you can do there with this rehypothecation. All that rehypothecation is you buy something, you get a security, you repo it out, now you have money again. So then you buy something else, and then you lend that out, on and on and on. And this game works as long as your financing stays low. So that's why the idiot Fed that says we're going to keep rates low, for 2 years or your rest of your lifetime, encourages this kind of speculation because you don't have to worry about your financing costs go up. At the same time, what happens is when you don't have collateral, and this is what happened in 2008, why they lost control of the game, even when all the bailing out they were trying to do and all the facilities the Fed was creating, is people started grabbing for collateral because they got scared. When you have that many people buying and selling and repledging things, the chain breaks down. And once the chain breaks down, everything starts collapsing. As the book When Genius Failed said, what these guys are doing is they're picking up nickels in front of a bulldozer. In other words, you keep buying and lending securities more and more. It's a very, very, very small spread, especially with low interest rates. But you do it so many times. So in other words, if I can make a trade and make 20 cents on it, that's great. But if the spreads collapse down to only 2 cents, I've got to do 10 times the leverage. Now, if it goes down to 1 cent, right, 40 times, or if it's a half a cent, as long as I can keep levering that, I can maintain my profits. Not the profit margin, but the net profit. So as the profit margin decreases, margin is decreasing, you keep looking for more and more leverage. That's what's going on. That's what appears to have gotten MF Global here. And again, that's what got long-term capital to some degree.
So on collateral, we've got Dudley talking about taking European paper as collateral. We've got collateral, which, again, going back to 2008, 2009, we saw the Fed accept all kinds of stuff, including the kitchen sink into Maiden Lane 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
Speak to collateral a little bit, because isn't that really what we saw was a collateral call with MF Global?
The system is so levered, is that when, again, because of all this trading and speculation, all these derivatives and all this nonsense, is that when people get concerned, they grab for collateral, and then the whole thing breaks down. Because you're playing this high-speed game of buying and relending and relending, and all of a sudden you start, a few people pull the securities, and then you have shortages of collateral. And then this whole chain breaks down and reverses. When it reverses, you start losing money. And when you lose money, you take capital hits. And that makes you sell other things. And that's why commodities are getting crushed in here now, too. Now, sure, the global economy and austerity means it's going to have weaker government spending, which means weaker economies, but also the grab for collateral. And that's one of the reasons when the dollar goes up. If you remember, the dollar surged in October and November of 08, and gold just got crushed and everything got crushed because that's what was going on. They said when people start grabbing for collateral, you run into the dollar because that's what you're short. You're short dollars when you borrow. You know, that the whole chain breaks down. Boom, 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 boom. And you see it happening in gold and the other commodities over the last month or so.
It's a challenging picture because as individuals,
yes,
you ultimately have to make a decision, an allocation decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems really boring to look at the areas where there's not a lot of counterparty risk. Physical gold, no counterparty risk there. Dollars, I suppose you could stuff your mattress with them, but it appears that even if you put them at the bank, you know, they may be rehypothecated. Nevertheless, yeah, I mean, between cash or their equivalents in gold, where else do you go in a period of unwind? Okay, so we go back to that big issue that you mentioned. There's a necessary hit that has to be taken. It was voluntarily done on a Reagan and Volcker. They took the hit. It's not being done on a voluntary basis, which means things are going to get worse, not better,
right,
in terms of the ultimate ramifications. When this happens, even on an involuntary basis, where do you want to be? Because there is no good place. There's just better places.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, exactly. That's exactly right. That's why the dollar is surging now, because it is a better place to be than in the euro or commodities, because we have deflation. We've had this ebb and flow of inflation, deflation. The system is trying to deflate. It's clear. It's been trying to deflate for over 12 years. That's what the big stock bubble collapse in 2000 was. And then you have central bank and governments trying to stave off the debt deflation because they think it's too horrible. And in the meantime, they've bankrupted themselves. And they've bankrupted individuals. They've bankrupted banks, on and on and on. Instead of letting the system wash out, they just wouldn't, Greenspan wouldn't allow it because he was afraid that it would take the bank because there's just too much lever. So they make it worse and worse and worse. They could have done this in 91 when Citibank was down for the first time. Bank of Boston, Bank of New England, you had all those banking problems in the 91. And he bailed them all out, didn't it, with the carry trade. And then Bank of Japan went to zero interest rates in 95. And they've been playing, so this thing's been going on for two decades of trying to stave off the day of reckoning for the financial markets.
So what makes us think that 2012 to 2016 is the period where there is a forced comeuppance? Because, surprise, surprise, at the end of 12 years, we continue to be able to kick the can down the road.
Well, you can keep doing as long as you can borrow. And that's what's happening now. That's why the real crisis is the sovereign debt crisis. Because that's the ultimate guarantor.
That is the game changer.
Right. That is because, so, well, you always can get bailed out. You know, and that's what we did. You know, that's what Greenspan did. You've got two decades. Well, make it go back to 87. You're looking at 25 years of bailing out people. So if somebody comes into business at 22 or 23, you're talking basically everybody under the age of 50 has been in a market where they always believe someone's going to bail out the markets or whatever. And that's a lot of experience. And the same token, you haven't had a bear market in bonds for 30 years. So again, you're talking about almost anybody under the age of 55 hasn't traded in a real bond bear market. The rates have always gone down. So you might go up for a quarter or two or a year, but you always get saved. And the reason is because the governments kept buying bonds, whether it was for their own good or for currency intervention. So you've had in an unbelievable period of central bank and government intervention in the markets and the economies to save the socialistic model that developed early last century, whether it was the European socialism or communism or the U.S. socialism that Roosevelt created in the 30s. This is an unwind of 75 years or more of this economy and financial system, and it's going to be very painful. And they're just trying, again, they're just trying to extend and pretend and hope for some magic genie to show up so they don't have to take the hit. But you're right, the market is forcing the hit. And you could see it just like it did with communism when it started breaking up, 89, 90, 91. It just, the weakest nations just kept falling and falling and falling. And now that we've spread into Europe, where the weakest nations are going down first there, and their forms of socialism. You know, you go through Greece, you go through Portugal, you know, wherever you're going to go on this stuff, Ireland, Iceland, and it's just going to roll through the regions like that. And that's what we're looking at here. And the big problem now is it isn't one. It's everybody, because everybody has played this game for decades. And it's the end game, because when you can't borrow money anymore or the rates start going up, then we're going to see the debt default. And that's what I see. I see debt default where you just, and just look at history. This happens. You try to inflate. You try to borrow. You try austerity. There's nothing new here. This has all been done many, many times. Then your only recourse then is either to go Weimar and just print it up and pay it, or you default. And the recent history is you default, whether it was Russia in, what was that, 98? You had in 01 and 02, where we had Argentina, we had other countries in there. You default because that's what's best for your country. And that's what leaders will figure out eventually is, okay, we just can't pay it. And it's not so drastic. Russia, within, what, 3-4 years, is running incredible surpluses and acquired $200-300 billion in reserves, a lot of which do because the energy took off. But that's where people do the work. You see, if you can default, and it works for your country, if when you default, you do the necessary reforms. Because then you can get back into the capital markets and borrow again. And they have. So again, the game here is for the elites to try to bail each other out without taking the hit.
Is it any different for a country that has reserve currency status?
Yeah, it would be. It would be, and that's, you know, with the U.S. Because, you would lose. Again, it becomes, if you do the necessary reforms. I would tell you right now, if you came out and you said, we're going to run a balanced budget, we're going to have a flat tax, we're going to get all this nonsense, we're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. Oh, by the way, we're going to default. Your T-bills here, you're only going to get, whatever it is, we're going to give you whatever the number is, 2/3, whatever it is. And it would take that hack and whack. And at first, people would be cautious to see if you followed that plan. But if you followed that plan, you'd be fine. I mean, look how fast Russia rebounded.
Right.
It was very quickly. And what was their history of jurisprudence or business dealing? Please.
Well, in terms of a default, you've got roughly 50-50 split, if you're looking at a treasury market, mm-hmm. held by foreigners versus held domestically. So,
mm-hmm. But who holds it domestically? If you start talking about, and this was my view of why you should nationalize, you shouldn't bail out Wall Street. You bail out all the bank deposits. When you start looking at the United States with the average household and what their assets are, there's very little.
Right.
You're only talking a handful of people with assets. So when you're talking treasury and you're talking default, you're talking about the 1% by and large. And institutions, obviously pension funds and insurance companies and whatever in here. But the average guy, it's not going to impact the average person on the street. Not to his balance sheet. You know, it will have effect on the economy and whatever in the short term. And that's why you will get default eventually, because the majority of people aren't impacted. Their balance sheet and checkbook isn't impacted. Because what assets they do have are in bank accounts. They're in passbooks, maybe CDs. There's not a lot of people holding T-bills, maybe in some money funds and whatever like that. But it's not the same. It's not the same as the big institutionalized money that would get hit, or the big private wealth. That's why the big private wealth has been big buyers in gold. That's their hedge. They buy gold, and they're buying bonds, and they just waiting it out.
Hypothetically, you look at 2012, 13, 14, 15, and what do we see? Money market funds breaking the buck?
I don't know.
Institutions?
I don't know. See, the thing is, rightly so on the street is the argument, deflation or inflation. And we've been getting periods of both over the last decade.
Correct.
But deflation shows up because the system wants to deflate. And again, the central banks and governments are trying to prevent it by inflating.
Inflate it back.
But right now we're in deflation again. You can see in the commodities are telling you that. And Bernanke did. Bernanke moved away from QE2 in May. And nobody listened to him. The FOMC said the trade-offs of quantitative easing are no longer beneficial. And I'm like, what else do people need to hear? But you had the same clowns running around going, oh, QE3 is imminent. It's imminent. It's imminent. It's imminent. And you can look and see the rallies. You know, when you did the QE2, you could see the bonds just, you know, went down, stocks and commodities went up, and then it kind of rolled over. And then we had the twist. You had another little rally there, of course, the October, and then that all fell apart. And now everybody's running around, oh, QE3 in January, QE3 in January. Well, I don't think so, but the point being here is we're getting both inflation and deflation on a periodic basis. Now, what's the next big wave? I don't know. But the one thing that I'm highly confident is we will get both. If some point in the future here, it's probably not going to be 2012 because the election was afterwards, maybe, you know, a year from now, 2013 or whatever, when the new administration and new Congress or whatever come in and start doing reforms, you'll get the deflation. And it depends how far they'll allow it to go before they inflate. On the other hand, if you have an administration and Congress comes in and tries to inflate right away, we'll get the inflation, but then that'll blow up and we're going to get deflation. So my view is we're going to get a big wave of inflation and deflation because that's what history tells us. We just don't know the sequence. So you have to have a portfolio constructed so that you're hedged against both, and when the wave develops, you can jump on and play it. You know, you won't get swamped and crushed by it.
So we've got Dennis Gartman saying we're in a new bear market in gold. Is he talking about a secular bear or a secular bear? I mean, is it over?
It's too early to tell. Too early to tell. It depends on what the governments do. It's way too early to tell.
We've got gold up 630% during the duration of the last 10 years, silver up 700%. Mm-hmm. These are off of recent, these aren't high numbers, these are current numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they've had a good run.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't seen any sort of speculative blow-off phase, which you might expect at a tail end of a super bull market. Maybe that's around the corner, maybe it's not. But, yeah, inflation, deflation, we know that you've got fiscal measures that can be employed and monetary measures which can be employed.
Mm-hmm.
Fiscal are not all that popular with your voter base, unless you're sort of lynching the rich. And unfortunately, there's not enough money to take and steal and reallocate to actually make a difference there. But fiscal measures really don't work. I guess we've looked at the monetary measures as the only ones that they would employ, because they're not politically volatile, not if they can, quote-unquote, control the inflation. And maybe that's their misperception, that they can't actually control it. It tends to move.
It's the arrogance of these guys, mostly these Ivy League types, who spend a career saying, oh, we just have to make the right policy mix. No, you don't. You're not that smart. Well, you've proven it over the last how many decades you're not that smart, so why don't we just get out of the way and let the market operate? Of course, they're saying now as well, we can't because it'd be so horrible. Yeah, that's the horror you guys created with your Keynesianism, monetarism, and everything else, that you're always going to be there to fine-tune and micromanage the economy and the financial system, and it's not working. That's another reason why they're digging in. This isn't just the banks. This isn't just the country. This is these guys' lifetime work. It's their self-esteem. It's their egos, and they're going to try to prove that they're right at all costs, no matter what the costs are. And it's another reason why you have to get rid of, you got to let the market work and get rid of all these clowns that want to put their fingers in the pie and keep manipulating it. And there you are. You're getting revolts. You're getting revolts all over the world about this type of action. And it's going to continue. And you're seeing that you're starting to get the social unrest. You're starting to see it here in the U.S., of course. And, you know, we don't see it in Europe because they don't talk about it as much here, but it's going on. And it's probably going to worsen because nobody is doing the requisite reforms. So you just keep making it worse and worse. You know, people will take a hit and pain if they believe you're going to have a better future, which is what 81 and 82 was under Reagan. And even Thatcher did the same thing. Nobody here wants to do that, or in Europe. Nobody wants to go in and take and say, okay, we're going to do what's necessary here to reform. And until you do, we're going to play the silly game until the market revolts, like in 2008 when the market revolted. And the market's revolting now, and you can see they just keep trying to stop it. And that's one of the reasons why they keep trying to keep the stock. I mean, that's the QE. That's the only thing they're doing the QE for. It hasn't gotten in the economy. It's not helping. It's not helping housing. And when people said to Bernanke, whether it was the national media or whoever said, QE is not working, or why did you think QE was working? The first word out of his mouth was stock prices are up. First words out of his mouth. That's the only thing they can hang their hand on is we're inflating assets. And the reason they think that helps is that they're trying to get the banks recapitalized. That's what this thing comes down to, saving the big banks, saving sovereign debt. And the reason the sovereigns and the central banks are in trouble is because they were bailed out. They got too involved in the economy. They got too involved in the financial system. And now they're on the hook. And that's, again, that's the game changer.
So not 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015. We're still talking about a slow burn. It takes forever until it just happened and it's done.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're really, you're looking, there's only two possible outcomes. Is one, the market revolts. The second is you get the right leaders in, get ahead of that. And which is kind of like Volcker and Reagan did. They both did. They both saw how bad it was. They understood the problem, both of them. And see, that's the problem here is you have to give the medicine and the but you have to also, you have to purge, but you also have to restructure. If the U.S. economy wasn't restructured, in other words, if we just did austerity, it would have been horrible. So you got to do your austerity, but you also have to liberate the private market so it can do its work, just like after World War II. Everybody thought we were going into this enormous depression, back into the depression, because all the men were coming home, millions of men coming home. You know, there's going to be massive unemployment, you know, on and on and on. And we had this enormous boom. Now, it took a little bit. It took, you know, 3-4 years to purge that out. But then by 49 to 66, it was unbelievable prosperity because you had pent-up savings, pent-up demand after World War II. And did your restructuring and off to the races, the private market worked, and it worked splendidly. We did the same thing in 1920. You know, people call it the Forgotten Depression. The same thing. After World War I, enormous inflation, crushed the global economies. The scale of World War I had never been seen in history, and the costs were unimaginable at that time. And the problems, of course, led to Weimar Germany, whatever. But here in the U.S., we had prosperity because we were supplying grains and materials, supplies in World War I, and incredible inflation. You had the same thing, men coming home. All of a sudden, the factories and the farms weren't as prosperous. The demand wasn't there for Europe. And Warren G. Harding was getting the advice that, oh, my, to get out of this depression, you should increase your government spending and raise taxes, blah, blah. He went the other way. Cut government spending in half, slash taxes. Took a year and a half to purge, and then you went on the roaring 20s, boom, because you did the right thing. That's what we're needing here. Just like Thatcher did when she started blowing up the British socialism. Of course, she got benefit of North Sea oil coming online at too, which helped. But you know, until you get someone here who goes, okay, we're going to take the hit for a year and a half, and we're going to do it right, and we're going to come out. So that's the problem in Europe. They want to stick austerity measures on people, but they don't want to blow up the structure to unleash the private sector. And unless you unleash the private sector, get the government off the backs, downsize government, you're just gonna crush your country. You're going to have some kind of revolution because people aren't going to take the austerity forever.
Well, we have two different kind of revolutionaries to remember this week. Vaclav Havel passed away, and so did Kim Jong-il.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, you've got freedom, which came on the other side of revolution. And on the other, 2 million people starved to death and nuclear weapons. Those are sort of his claims to fame or infamy. The kind of leadership that we need, can you imagine it? Can you draw a caricature of that leadership? And do you see that emerging this election cycle, or is that something we've got to wait another election cycle for here in the U.S.?
You know what? It depends on the country. The good thing with the U.S., I was very negative in 2008-9. And what was happening, and you know, maybe you should get your money out of the country, but I think the reason you see the dollar rallying is the people in Europe seem to want more socialism. When in the U.S., you read the surveys, you read everything, they want less. Most of the people in this country realize the problem is government's too big, too much government spending. And, of course, you've got career politicians and you've got the dependency class in the U.S. go out of their mind. That's why you have the venom at the Tea Party. What the Tea Party keeps saying is we want to cut government spending. And that is so abhorrent to the vested interest of the big government and the welfare state. They go out of their mind. But it's coming. It's going to happen. The mathematics tell you that the spending is going to get cut. It's going to get slashed. It's going to disappear in a huge way. So if you have the right leaders, you prepare the country for this, but you also have to prepare the means to get out, which, again, is to unleash the private sector, which is, we all know what it means. It means that you crush government, government regulations, structure of government, government workers, government spending, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's how you get out of this. You know, everybody understands this, except, again, the diehard dependence of the state. And if they had any sense, they would understand that that's all going to disappear and that they're better off letting this, getting a productive economy. See, that's the thing here in the U.S. The U.S. had such enormous economic and financial advantage after World War II that it was just incredible. Never in history of man had you had a nation this powerful and in such an industrial and financial base. So by the mid and late 60s, you just started, you unleashed the welfare state in an enormous way. And the same thing in the cities. All these deals, it was just ridiculous. And you struggled in the 70s, you started bankrupt. Then Reagan and Volcker unleashed the U.S. economy again, and you went berserk in the 80s and into the 90s, and you got away with this. And now, you know, that all the global economies are rolling over because you had this massive transfer of wealth to from the Western world to emerging markets, you can't support the socialism anymore. It's just like a family. If you got a family of five, two are very productive, and the other three live off them, that's great. And all of a sudden, you only got one productive, it starts to become a struggle because you got four living off it. And when the one that is productive all of a sudden is getting reduced, then the whole thing comes down. That's the Western world. It cannot afford its social welfare state that it's created over the last, however, 70, 80 years, whatever it is. And it's coming. We're unwinding a social, political, economic system. That's what's going on. It's huge. It's beyond secular. This is Kondratiev type of stuff. And that's why we're stuck in this. And we've been stuck in this for years.
Out of that Kondratiev-type change comes either leadership that you're pretty excited about or leadership that you really want to sort of hide from. We've seen both, the good and the bad. What would you suggest is a way that we could either help or promote or get behind positive change as we see this requisite purging occur? What kind of mindset would you suggest we need to take on?
The mindset? Well, I just think people have to be informed. I think one of the reasons you're getting this now is because the elite media has lost control of the megaphone. You know, you have the internet, you have other sources of information and data. So people in the U.S. have to understand what the problems are here. And again, what you're hoping here is that you get leaders behind, that the people put in the leaders that will do what is necessary. Right now, though, I don't see that happening, especially over the next year. And even in 2013, I still think the events are going to force people. And we've seen this in times of war, the same thing, is that the events force people to do things. And we just hope we have the leaders in charge that when the real game starts playing can make the adjustments on the fly and understand what's happening and can lead the nation and get the people to do what has to be done. So, that's still a long way in front of us, I believe.
Yeah, it sounds like we're talking about a totally different election cycle, not this one.
FDR ran on in 32 was cutting the deficit. That's what he ran on. That, Hoover was recklessly spending on and on. And he came in, he did a 180. So that's where, I don't care what people campaign on and what they say. What do they do, especially when the game is being played, when it's real time and there's real situations and real dangers and opportunities appearing? Are you mentally and emotionally agile enough and smart enough to make the adjustments quickly and lead the nation on the proper course? We'll see.
Well, what a happy note to head into Christmas with.
the good news is if you're paying attention and you are reasonably sound portfolio, you're not levered, you're not in big debt, and you have a nice cash reserve, and you have your hedges against that cash, you can sit and wait and watch. Because there's a lot of people that are desperate, are panicky, and they're fighting for their lives. Now, again, if you're treading water, you're winning right now.
Yeah, for the layman, essentially you're talking about a cash and gold position. Cash and a hedge against it.
Yeah, it's something like that. Well, not farmland anymore. It got overpriced. One of the reasons I think grains are in trouble here is because if you have a family farm, you don't care what the price was and you produce your crops. Now, you're some hedge fund or private equity group, and you're paying all-time highs for farmland. All of a sudden you start trying to produce every square inch of that property. And so you could just see that the size of the crops now are just enormous. And that's how the commodity markets work. You produce too much and the price goes down. So it's a game we just don't quite know. The information isn't good out there. It's being guarded. They don't want people to know the truth. They're not telling the truth. So you just got to be very, very careful and you got to be very defensive in what you own. If you can own stocks here, but you better have verifiable sound balance sheets. I wouldn't touch a big bank right now because there's just no way to verify what their real holdings are. I mean, just remember, when Washington Mutual sold for $2 billion, it was carrying a book value of $75 billion. It sold for $2 billion. How good was all that financial analysis and balance sheet analysis? So here, you got some great companies, some of your top tech companies, some of your like Johnson & Johnson, Exxon, these type companies that are good, sound balance sheets, low in debt, a lot of cash, and a company that's going to exist no matter what we get first, inflation, then the big deflation or vice versa, that's fine. And on a micro level, you're looking for businesses that are going to be able to generate cash. That's what you want. You want businesses that can generate cash no matter what kind of environment we have.
Well, we look forward to having you back on the program sometime next year.
Okay, great.
And looking forward to a dinner in Chicago before too long.
That'd be very nice.
Well, David, it is Christmas time, but that was a sobering talk. You know, when you look back at 2008 and 2009, just so much went on. Bill says that was a crisis, but not the crisis. So we need to hold on for
well,
what...
Because all of these problems continue to get pushed uphill, if you will, and the responsibility is given to someone who has deeper pockets.
Right.
In this case, we've reached the end game, so to speak, because the sovereign's ability to borrow or inability to borrow ends up being the game changer.
Well, and you know they're running out of room because when Europe wants to give the IMF money so that they can give it back to them, and, you know, they're just playing, like you said, they're just playing games at this point. They're out of money. Now, when people start to realize that, that daisy chain stops rolling. And that's what Bill's bringing out, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think, Kevin, one of the things that he is suggesting, the voluntary purging is more attractive than the involuntary where the market forces it.
Right.
Because guess what? You actually put yourself at a strategic advantage. Let's say, for instance, that in 2012, we had leadership that came in and was very strategic about what they put in place in terms of policy measures. And they were both austere and, Bill said, also something that helped restructure our economy. So on the one hand, austerity, on the other, restructuring the economy for growth. If those two things were introduced in 2013 as a result of the elections in 2012, then we might, in fact, be the country to lead through the crisis. If we don't, then the question is, who leads if they're willing to take the hit voluntarily? Otherwise, we may find ourselves all in one nasty stew pot, all of us dealing with the same thing, taking the hit, but the market forcing it on all of us at inopportune times.
Well, and you know, hindsight is 20/20, I know, but we've had Paul Craig Roberts on, and Paul Craig Roberts was with the Reagan administration when they were trying to get some things through that would have continued to make the economy grow, but there was conflict at the time. You had Volcker, who was coming in and tightening things up, and actually, there were certain steps that were taken by the Reagan administration at that time as well to clean things up from the Carter years, to clean things up from the early 70s, even the mistakes that Nixon made before he resigned. You know, looking back, that was painful. 81, 82, 83, those were painful years, but look at what happened after that. That's what Bill brought out.
Well, and I think even scooting back a little further, 74, 75, you had painful years that preceded it, but you didn't have a voice of leadership.
Right.
And so, you know, Bill's also correct in saying, you know, listen, if this is painful, what people will listen and people will tolerate the pain if they think they are following someone who is credible, who has the ability to say, here's where we're going, this is what we're going to do, watch how I get it done. It reminds me a little bit of Yuval Steinitz and what he rolled out for the Israeli government, saying, listen, here's how we're going to increase taxes, and this is how we're going to decrease taxes in an orderly fashion immediately. Yes, we're going to use fiscal tools to solve this problem. This is back in 2008 and 9.
Right.
But this is our credible way of both solving the problem and unwinding it. We're not looking for overreaching our boundaries. We're not looking at permanently stretching our new found capital in terms of revenues to be allocated beyond the crisis into pet projects. But if we have to increase the pain today, we'll decrease it tomorrow, we promise you. And you know what? Steinitz was right.
Right.
He did what he said he was going to do, and they've done quite well, actually, in terms of recovery.
Well, then, during this period of unknown, since the people who are listening to us, most of them are not policymakers or decision makers in Washington. There may be a few. But for the person who says, yeah, David, it's Christmas time. I'm trying to figure out what to do with my finances. I'm looking at this last year. I'm confused. What do I do now? You know, you and your dad, last week when you were talking on the program, came to the conclusion that you really need to keep your powder dry and ride this thing out so that you can move the right direction when it presents itself. Is that what you would suggest?
It is, and it comes back to something that's very simple, sort of that back-of-the-napkin conversation with the perspective triangle, where you have a balanced approach where a third of your capital is powder that's kept dry, a third of your capital is allocated to creating a hedge for the capital that is kept dry. So, I mean, you've got precious metals, which are an offset to your currency risk in your liquid position, and then you also have a productive bet, a play on recovery, if you will, you know, where equities and bonds can be in the mix, selectively chosen. You do have that balance built in. And, Kevin, as basic as that is, I think you come back to the basics in these challenges challenging times, because if you don't have those basics figured out and covered, then you don't have anything covered.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.